AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's RUBRIK.com.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Brought to you by Standard Life. Retirement specialists getting you ready for your second life.
Now, 2025 has been another big year for CEO of Tilting the Lens and member of the Council of State, Sinead Burke, with multiple honours received and with a new year almost on us. It's a great pleasure to welcome her to the show today to find out what's coming in 2026. Sinead, you're very welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's lovely to be here.
Thanks for being on. So how'd you get on over the Christmas? Have you any traditions that you guys stick to in your family?
It was just so lovely to do nothing. I have had a year of lots of lovely travel, interesting work, but a lot of time not being able to do anything else but work and those things. So Christmas this year was very calm, quiet, with family, did some knitting, read some books, watched some terrible television, which I think was just what I needed.
Sounds about the perfect Christmas.
Absolutely, absolutely. And lots of chocolate and crisps and potato and all of that.
All the joyous stuff. How's been 2025 been? You've been, even reading through the list of things you've gotten through, the awards you've been given, I feel tired just looking at it.
You know, I think if I was reflecting back to January 2025, you know, there was definitely, I think, some uncertainty for me, for the work that I do, and maybe for context for the listeners. You know, I run a business called Tilting the Lens, as you kindly said, which is a strategic accessibility consultancy. So the work that we do is trying to work with companies, governments, small businesses, the disabled people themselves, really to create the conditions for disabled people to be successful. And at the beginning of January, I think there was lots of uncertainty, whether that was around what does inclusion look like in workplaces or in different parts of the world. And I think I had some hesitancy and some nervousness about what that means in terms of continuing to grow a business in that climate. But I think one of the things that I've really taken from the year is just that continued commitment for people, that actually what we're trying to do is to create a fairer world, whether that's in the workplace, whether that's for people as citizens, whether that's for people as consumers. And I think I'm ending the year looking forward into 2026 with a bit of calm and with a bit of, I guess, contentment that commitment is still there from people at all different kind of levels of power, levels of industry. So it's been a strong year of really trying to do that work. So, for example, whether that's the scholarship that we have for disabled fashion students at Parsons School of Design, whether that is about, you know, supporting businesses and governments with reasonable accommodations processes for disabled people to be set up for success in the workplace, or whether that's thinking about, you know, doing further research and kind of sharing that more openly with people and kind of open sourcing it in general. But yeah, I think I started the year with more hesitancy than hopefully I'm ending it with.
And do you find companies now, like, how are, bring us inside what kind of engagements they're having? Because I suppose in the past, we've often thought about accessibility maybe as an add-on or something that's nice to have rather than something that's a part of the design of a business or even somewhere out in public spaces. So what, like, are people coming to you now going, we need to change this, or getting you to evaluate what they have? How does it work?
So I think one of the big turning points actually came this year. So on June 28th, 2025, the European Accessibility Act came into law, which requires businesses of a certain size, particularly those that are kind of business to consumer, making sure that their digital products are accessible and meet a minimum standard of accessibility. I think in advance of that law coming in, we had a lot of companies coming to us saying, you know, what does it mean to meet the criteria and to be compliant? And I think our approach has always been compliance is really important, and it's really important that we have local, national and global standards, but actually no standard encapsulates or includes everyone. It continues to leave so many people behind. So yes, let's reach compliance, but actually what does that mean to go beyond it to ensure that, you know, if somebody has more than one disability, for example, or if somebody has, you know, multiple different identities that shapes how they show up in the world, that they are centered to the process and included too. So I think we've seen really a mindset shift in companies ensuring that, okay, great, we can meet the box, we can ensure that we don't have to pay a fine, but actually, how do we think about this from a consumer lens? And the best way to do that has been in designing those things with people. So one of the things that we've been really trying to do this year is a process of co-design. So ensuring that whether it's around banking or fashion, or whether it's around kind of education, ensuring that those consumers are at the heart of it, designing the solutions, because they're closest to the problem. But I think we're still on, you know, a journey, to use that terrible phrase. You know, if we look at Ireland, even for example, you know, we have very low rates of disabled people in employment. We tie with Greece in the European Union as regards to that. And I think there is still so much work to be done. And part of that is the mindset piece that you talked about, that still accessibility is often something considered, oh, well, do we have to do that? Or it's considered as something that we do at the very end. And I think the reality is, unless we're building it in from the very outset, whether that's a building, whether that is, you know, kind of new cycle pathways, or whether that's thinking about urban planning, or whether that's thinking about, you know, the design of a new radio program, for example, is it accessible from the outset? Mm. What that means is it creates the best possible outcome that people can engage with it, disabled people specifically, but also that that has just a greater value for everybody. And I do think that we will hopefully continue to see that shift. And I think one of the things that will also help with that is often what we hear companies saying is, well, what's the return on this? You know, I have to make an investment. Is there a return? And I don't think we should always do things just for the fact that there is a return. But I do think the fact that there is one, and that we're beginning to be able to calculate what the value of this is for companies and consumers alike, is actually important and will hopefully kind of create that momentum further.
Are there any particular areas or industries that you found have particular challenge? And I don't mean from a desire to do it. I mean that, you know, there is actually just barriers that make adapting to accessibility difficult, or stuff that you have to think about a little bit more.
I think one of the things in the built environment, so, you know, to give you some context, we do kind of three pillars of work: built environment, product and service design, and people and workplace culture. And I think one of the things in certain parts of the world that's really challenging around the built environment is historic and protected buildings. So, for example, we're currently working on a project that's based in New York that is a large scale cultural institution in a historic protected building. And it is very difficult to try to think about meaningful solutions in order to ensure that disabled people can access that space. Mm. So, you know, one of the things that's in place is there is legislation, quite rightly so, protecting the architecture of those buildings. And we need to ensure that as we think about, you know, cities and towns kind of growing older, that there's a, you know, kind of consistency in how buildings are set up. But I think one of the things that we do need to challenge that often exists in, from a mindset perspective, is that to make something accessible means that it makes it either ugly or less aesthetically pleasing, or that, you know, in order to make it accessible, it's going to be hugely cost in terms of just trying to create that change. And of course, sometimes there is a cost. And sometimes, you know, there is rarely an opportunity where to make something accessible makes it ugly. That's just bad design. Mm. But I think one of the things that we have to continuously ask ourselves as societies is it still right that only certain people get to access certain buildings? Or is it right that only certain people get to access the building around the back, or by the entrance with the bins, or by the entrance via the cars? Is it not kind of a moral right that we have that everybody gets to enter through the front door with safety and with dignity? And of course, with design-led solutions in mind. So I think there's still, again, some work that's needed from a policy perspective in thinking about those things in order to be able to ensure that access again moves forward and progresses further.
Mm. You mentioned those employment opportunities, and look, we've all heard stories of it, people who may be very well qualified, they may have degrees in their particular field, and they just find it particularly difficult to get into the area in which they have a qualification, particularly in the world we live in when there are so many more opportunities, be it remote working, e-working, whatever it is. Why do you think that's still coming up as such a barrier for some people?
Well, it's interesting. I think in the era of AI and recruitment, we're seeing whatever progress we kind of thought we were making being pushed back in some way. I think, you know, it's not hard to imagine that in terms of how large language models and generative AI is built, it is, of course, built with the bias of those who build it. So I think what we're seeing is, you know, in terms of how resumes and CVs are now being designed, they're being quickly scanned and that bias is taking place. We are seeing maybe less kind of flexibility in interview scenarios. Now, one of the things that we know that really works is providing interview questions in advance to people. And I think often what we find from some workplaces is, oh, but then a person will be too prepared. And say, well, surely we want the candidate to be prepared. Surely we want prepared people in our organization. And what is it that we're testing? It doesn't work in every interview environment. Of course, if you're trying to hire a software engineer, you want to be able to see, for example, that they can code. Or if you're hiring a surgeon, of course, you want to understand that they have the level of skill needed for that role. But there's so many jobs in which we could actually make the recruitment process just much more accessible.
And sorry to cut across you there, but just because we know so many more recruitment companies are using AI to filter out CVs or as to do, frankly, the first couple of stages of it, is that potentially actually an advantage for some people who have a disability? Because on a CV, you just have the qualifications, which would be the exact same as somebody who might, you know, not have some of those disabilities or an access problem. And yet, then when you get to the physical interview, is that where some of the bias comes in, or have you seen any effect of AI?
We have seen, in terms of often what we've talked to disabled people about, and even in the workplace, is this kind of, you know, almost cycle of doom, that even in terms of the CV, yes, to your point, you know, actually what exists in terms of the CV, in terms of skills, should be judged fairly. But I think the challenge is that what we're finding is, in terms of the AI itself, it is built with a bias. So perhaps it's more attuned to a certain type of tone of voice or a certain type of language, or perhaps it, you know, aggregates those forward that have actually been designed with AI. So if you're not writing your resume or CV with AI, maybe you're less likely to be put forward. So I think there is some things that are actually getting lost and getting trapped within that piece of even just the CV review because of how things are written, or because of, you know, in terms of the biases that are there as the norm. But then, yes, we are then seeing a gap. But often where we find the greatest challenge is, for example, a person may do well in the interview, may score well, and often they may self-identify and say that they are disabled or have an access need, either early in the process or in the interview or after the interview. But what we're finding is just this significant gap between a person starting in their role, for example, and the accommodation being put in place. So often what we find is we talk to people and we engage with people who are deaf, for example, and a sign language interpreter is not in place for the first 2 weeks of their employment. So they're not able to engage meaningfully in the workplace or prove a certain skill. Or we're seeing people who maybe need assistive technology, whether that's a screen reader or use of a software like Grammarly if you have dyslexia or you're neurodivergent. But nobody has done the advanced thinking to understand, is that compatible with cybersecurity, for example, depending on the company that you work with. And often that person then is left in limbo. And then, of course, everybody is wondering, is this person performing? But it's not that they're not performing, they're just not set up for success. Yeah. Or often what you find is that in terms of the hiring manager or the external recruitment person, there's a gap in information or communication, or there's no legacy memory. No company has a list and says, you know what, these are all of the accommodations we can quickly approve because they're under 50 euro or 100 euro. So let's just go, let's get started. Whereas often what it feels like is this laborious process where often the disabled person themselves who's in the job is never talked to, is never asked what they need or what they want. They're spoken about as if they're a problem to solve rather than this amazing talent who's going to support and kind of enhance the organization. So often what we find it is that, and I think it's about changing the mindset that this is not about giving disabled people something extra to be able to do their job. This is about acknowledging that for forever, the workplace has been really inaccessible and unfair for everybody. And actually what we're trying to do piece by piece is just make sure that people can do their job. And often what we hear from employers is, oh, but what about if the person is not very good at their job? It's like, okay, well, if they're in the job a long time, we put in a performance improvement plan. We maybe see if there's training or opportunity. But if from the very outset, they don't have the right skills match to be able to do the job after you've put the accommodations in place, well, then like any person, if it's not the right fit for the job, if you weren't good at your job, Sean, you know, you wouldn't still be there. You wouldn't be in that job. And I think it's that. It's about providing opportunity, providing accommodations so that people can succeed. And I think so often we just still have certain biases of disabled people. And I think we have to unpick them every day. And I think what we are seeing is some really great progress around those who are neurodivergent in the workplace. So we're seeing some really great work around employee resource groups, which is often kind of collectives of employees who identify around one identity group or another. And I think we are seeing such great advocacy from neurodivergent people, which is amazing. I think the thing that we have to be sure that we're careful about is that nobody gets left behind, and we don't create hierarchies of access or hierarchies of disability or hierarchies of need, because I think what we're all trying to advocate for is just a better, more kind of flexible, understanding workplace for everybody.
Yeah. Look, there's a lot of talk about this during the election last year. Disability was a real hot topic issue. We now see a Minister for Disability that is sitting around the Cabinet table. But do you think the government has actually shown anything in the last year that would suggest to you they are taking the issues that you're talking about very seriously? Or is it a bit of window dressing to say, OK, now we've got a minister, don't worry about the problem?
One of the things that I do think is really important is in terms of the most recent strategy that it was underpinned by human rights. I think in talking to whether it's disabled people organisations or disabled advocates here in Ireland, I think so often it has felt like in terms of the model of disability that we're still talking about the medical model of disability. So often the medical model of disability is about that disability is something to be fixed or something to be cured. I think then we've moved to the social model of disability, which is the understanding that disabled people are disabled by the environments around them. So whether that's the built environment or policies. And I think it is a real progress that actually now what we're talking about is disabled people have a right. And with that, the government have to be accountable to that right. We're seeing the UN Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities and the Optional Protocol being ratified. But I think the next piece then is about accountability. It's about in terms of that strategy, what are the metrics that we're actually going to be accountable for every quarter or, you know, every month that we can be reporting on so that there is and sees progress. I think the other piece is also about while absolutely there is a necessity for investment in disability services. And we hear every day the trauma, the pain, the challenge, the exclusion, the ableism that disabled people, their families and their caregivers are facing due to a lack of funding or a lack of opportunity and access to disability services. But I also think we need to make sure that there is focus as regards to accessibility, as regards to disability rights outside of disability services too, equally. Disability services do an excellent job, but it should not be the only focus. We need to be ensuring that we are not just solving for yesterday and fixing the problems of yesterday, but that we are thinking about the disabled person who's about to turn 18 and may lose their medical card or their benefits when they go into third level education. We need to think about the disabled person who is 45 and has to go into a nursing home because there's no other accessible accommodation that is available to them. We need to think about the disabled person who's 65, who's retiring, and what does that mean for them? Or the disabled person who's 35, who's been in the same job for 10 years and hasn't been promoted once, even though all of their colleagues has been. So I think it's how do we think about the life cycle of disabled people, acknowledging that some disabled people are born disabled, but the majority of disabled people acquire their disability over their lifetime, whether that's a chronic illness, whether that's a diagnosis of neurodivergence. So I think it's about having a much more holistic look. And that's not me saying it's easy. It's so challenging and so complicated because what we know is that no two disabled people, even if they have the same disability, may need the same thing. So how do we create not just policies, but systems that are flexible enough for an individual to be accommodated, but also ensure that from a population perspective, acknowledge and plan for that aging population, that life cycle of that person, and is, I guess, expansive enough to think about different kinds of people in different kinds of situations. But one of the things that I would love to see is that as we evolve from the human rights focus on the strategy, the next model of disability is really about disability justice. So what this specifically talks about is focusing on interdependence rather than independence. I think what we often hear around rhetoric of disabled people is their capacity to be independent. And I understand what that means, because what we want is to create the systems and the supports for people to be independent. But we often have this expectation of disabled people being independent in the way that we don't for non-disabled people. Non-disabled people get to be interdependent, get to be reliant on each other. And I think it's about holding those two concepts in kind of both hands rather than requiring disabled people to be independent in terms of being valid. And I think the last one is just around intersectionality. You know, what we're seeing now is making sure that policies and progress is really, you know, centered by disabled people from the traveling community, disabled people who are trans, disabled people who are people of color, ensuring that we're not always talking to the same kinds of people, but acknowledging that when you have multiple barriers, the solutions have to be solving for them rather than just solving for one kind of person that continues to leave those who are most marginalised even more marginalised by what is supposed to be progress.
Okay, Sinead Burke, CEO of Tilting the Lens and member of the Council of State, thanks so much for joining us on the show and for speaking so passionately, and have a great new year and a busy 2026. No doubt you will you'll be kept going.
Thanks so much. Happy New Year.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.